Was there a spiritual war before humanity began that continues to this day? Who are the Watchers? Did giants ever walk the earth? And if so, what happened to them? Are there fallen angels trapped beneath the earth, or half-breed chimera of angels and humans and other mystical spiritual beings that just are hanging around and messing with our world? Can we harness the good or fight against the bad spiritual forces via ley lines and energy grids? At what point does the exploration of mysterious stories from the Bible turn into fascination with the occult? We're going to be talking about all of that and more on today's episode of Theology on Air. Well, welcome back to Theology on Air. We're so glad you've joined us. We're going to be talking about all things giants and Nephilim and the Book of Enoch and all kinds of weird, mystical, kind of woo-woo stuff today. So we've invited our friend Austin Freeman to join us because we've typecast him now as that guy.
When you think about weirdo stuff, you think about Austin Freeman.
Yep. I've always said that.
Better than my reputation.
What's your reputation, Evan?
I'm get off your lawn cranky.
No, he's the cranky get off my lawn guy.
Seems like we go together then.
And I'm here just to add comical flavor, but I'm Sarah Stone. I'm the executive director for Theology by the Pint, joined, like we've already mentioned, by Evan McClanahan, senior pastor at First Lutheran Church here in Midtown, and Austin Freeman. He's a professor. I'll let you introduce yourself here in a second more, but he's a professor at HCU, and you've been on the podcast a few times now, and actually is going to be a guest speaker at an upcoming event in May talking about more weird woo-woo stuff, aliens and demons. At some point, we will have you talk about something that's not bizarre. But as you may know, Theology on Air, rather, is an offshoot of Theology by the Pint. This is the podcast where we get to go a little bit deeper into some of the topics that we discuss at our events. So if you live in the Houston area, we'd love for you to come to our in-person events. We have them every month, and they're really a lot of fun. You get to drink beer and wrestle through interesting ideas. You can find all the information on that and our podcast and everything, including how to give and support us and all the things at theologybythepint.org. But yeah, let's get into it. I'm excited about today's conversation. Austin, maybe just tell people a little bit about who you are, other than just being our weird woo-woo guy.
Sure. So aside from being your weird woo-woo guy, I'm also the weird woo-woo guy for Houston Christian University. I am the chair of the Department of Apologetics and assistant professor of theology at the School of Christian Thought at Houston Christian University. And the opinions expressed on this podcast are not necessarily the opinions of Houston Christian University, unless you like them, in which case they are, and you should come study with us.
Perfect.
And that is going to be my standard catchphrase from now on.
I like it.
So catchy.
I'm mostly focused on theology and literature and cultural apologetics and various pop culture, sci-fi, fantasy things, and there's quite a lot of overlap between sci-fi, fantasy, and what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, so. I texted Austin when I had the idea for this podcast, and I just threw out some of these terms and said, are you familiar with this kind of stuff? And he said, quite familiar, or something like that. So I thought, oh, perfect. But we're going to be talking about various things today that are, some of them are from the Bible, some of them are from extra-biblical books, so books that people think of in sort of conjunction with the Bible, but they didn't make it into the sort of official canon. Why didn't they make it in? But I became fascinated by some of these things because you, our viewers, are constantly sending me podcasts and articles that I should listen to or read. And I started seeing a theme among a whole faction of Christians and non-Christians around like cryptids, which is like, you know, Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and Dogman and all this kind of stuff, but also spiritual things. And we've talked before on this podcast about the Nephilim. We're going to talk about it again today, there's a few verses in Genesis that are kind of weird and no one quite knows what to do with them. And are they giants? And are they fallen angels? Are they half-breed? Anyway, but there are a lot of people that not only believe in a lot of the things in the Book of Enoch and Book of Jubilees, and we'll talk more about that in a second, but that we are in kind of a spiritual battle right now that includes some of that mysterious stuff. This actually does really affect your life. If it's true, it affects it. If it's not, it could affect it because it really does start to verge on obsession with cultish occult things. So that's what we're going to get into today. So I'm just going to ask Austin a bunch of questions and then push back where I think he's wrong, and we're going to get into it. Evan's just going to poke in whenever something sounds interesting.
I just focus the camera. So
that's not true.
So like if it's out of focus, I didn't do my one job, but go ahead.
And by the way, each of the questions I'm asking could be like its own podcast. So we're going to try to 30,000 foot view well, this thing.
I'm known for rapid fire responses sometimes.
That's true. So. That's true. You're a fast talker, and I appreciate that about you. So we'll start with something that I think most people have heard of when you were growing up. If you heard about like angels and demons and Satan, you probably heard this idea that, oh, before Adam and Eve, something happened and, you know, God made all these angels and some of them defected and maybe a third of them went with Satan and he's the bad guy who's in charge of the bad ones. And that's kind of what you learn in Sunday school growing up. But, the people that are into the stuff we're talking about today will refer to this as the war in heaven. And so I think we've talked on this podcast before about how, you know, God made various, you could call them Elohim, which is just a word for like a creature, right?
Small g God.
Okay. Yeah. And sometimes they're referred to in the Bible as gods with a lowercase g. And later when we talk about sons of God, it'll be like, oh, is it talking about Elohim? But that could be angels that we think of as good angels or the fallen angels. But maybe talk to us a little bit about the war in heaven. What happened before Adam and Eve, and what do we know and what don't we know?
Well, we don't know explicitly anything.
Yeah.
But Christian tradition has formulated a standard account, which is that at some point prior to Genesis 3, Satan was created as the most powerful or glorious of the angels. He rebelled, led most often a third of the angels with him in attempting to take over the throne of God. Irenaeus says actually he was just attempting to take over earth. But Satan and his angels are cast down from heaven and become what we know to be the demons. And now ever since then, they are intrinsically and irredeemably wicked and seek to steal, kill, and destroy all of the things that God is working on earth. And so the basis of this in Scripture comes from several places. We see it in Genesis 3 with the serpent that's talking to Eve. We see it in Isaiah and Ezekiel, these accounts where God is prophesying against these seemingly human figures, the king of Tyre, for instance. But then it sort of transitions into sounding like he's talking about something else. So there's a prince of Tyre, and then he starts talking about a king of Tyre. The assumption is that he begins by prophesying about this human ruler and then bifocal vision sort of zooms out to start talking perhaps about how this ruler is imitative of Satan and the primordial fall. But we see obviously a lot of this in Revelation as well. This is in Revelation is where we get the tie that Satan is the serpent in the Garden of Eden. That ancient serpent, the red dragon. This is where we get the phrase, there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels are warring against Satan and his angels, and he's cast down. Jesus says, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. We know Satan is in heaven at certain periods of time because he shows up there at the beginning of the book of Job, for instance. We talked about that in another episode here at Theology on Air, if you guys are interested in going back and listening to that one. All that to say, there is not an explicit biblical basis for that view, but it can be reconstructed based on some fairly solid implications that the Bible does mention.
Yeah. And the Bible talks in other places about there being a spiritual world.
Oh, all over
right? The place. That we don't just battle against flesh and blood, rulers and principalities. And we talked a little bit on he's referring to the demonology podcast that we did a few weeks ago, where we talked about this idea of the divine council. And so, yeah, you see in the story of Job, but also in the story of like Micaiah and maybe even like the Table of Nations, this idea that maybe in some weird, mysterious way, God, allows with and even gives sort of holds court with sort of good and bad Elohim. Of course he's in charge, but, that they're part of some kind of ruling body. I don't even know how you would say that, but. Which is bizarre for us to think about because we think about God being in charge and everyone else being subservient to him and that the demons aren't even a part of that conversation or anything. But
well, you do have to draw a distinction. There does seem to be a hierarchy. I'm not going to go into the pseudo-Dionysus nine choirs of angels or any of the very elaborate early modern hierarchies of barons and dukes of hell and all of that sort of stuff that we got in the early witchcraft trials. But there does seem to be a differentiation of role because you at least have an angel and an archangel. You have the B'nai Elohim and then you have unclean spirits. So there's different terms that are different roles that are at least gestured towards. We don't get a full job description anywhere, but the sons of God, or these the powers and principalities that Paul is talking about, don't necessarily seem to be the same thing as the rank and file of angels and demons. They seem to be at a higher echelon of authority or governance. And it's very much like any king in the ancient world. The king ostensibly rules as a complete sovereign. The king has absolute right over the whole empire, kingdom. But the king does have counselors and governors, and he's got his, you know, the royal hand washer and the
cupbearer.
Yeah, the cupbearer and the chamberlain of the bath and all of this stuff. And he doesn't necessarily need them. God certainly doesn't need them, but he does like to, in the overflow of his love, share his power and his authority in the ruling of the world that he has made with other creatures, including us, right? We're a part of that kingdom of God as well, and we have a particular authority. The New Testament says that we will exercise judgment over angels. So there's a hierarchy there. The term B'nai Elohim, the sons of God, seems to be quite a high-level descriptor. And that's where we see an overlap generally in the scholarly literature between the B'nai Elohim and the divine council. These are what I frequently just call the angelic governors. Hmm. And just as we have in the United States government, people who exercise their rightful office, but they do so unjustly while they're exercising it, they're not necessarily kicked out immediately. Judgment comes upon them at the appropriate time.
Yeah.
But that seems to be something like what we see in the ancient Near Eastern accounts in the Old Testament, is that in Psalm 81, for instance, God takes them to task for spoiling and wasting and abusing the authority that he has given them over the nations and fostering idolatry and violence and bloodshed.
Man, golly, that's so good. That almost makes me want to go political with it, but we're not going to, because I'm going to kind of work us through, I'm kind of going chronologically, and how things fall in the Bible. So that takes us to the seed war, which, by the way, in these podcasts that people send me, they refer to this like everyone knows this term. Everyone does not know this term. I now do know this term, but the seed war, you can elaborate a little bit, but my understanding is it's referring back to the moment after the fall where God is giving the curse to Adam and Eve and the serpent. Mm-hmm. And he's saying the thing about the seed of the woman will crush the seed of the serpent. And so it's setting up these two camps, these two teams. So all those people that make fun of me for saying Team Jesus, there's really something here. There really is a Team Jesus.
According to the seed war proponents, yes.
Well, even before I knew about the seed war, I mean, there is a, and you know, you hear in the New Testament that like you brood of vipers, there's references to sort of the team of the serpent, those that are against God's kingdom.
You are of your father, the devil.
Right. Okay. So, but tell us a little bit about the seed war. And I mean, would you use that term?
No.
Okay.
Seed war is a YouTube term. It is not a term that appears in the scholarly literature or any sort of, academic theological documents. But that's the basis, is that there is a lot of legend surrounding Adam and Eve in the garden, of varying ages. So for instance, Jewish folklore says that Adam had a wife before Eve. She was named Lilith,
and
she was created directly by God. And Lilith, can we get PG-13?
I mean, sure. This guy always does.
All right. So
I do.
So,
but Adam, if you have kids and you're listening, maybe take a 5-minute break.
So Adam and Lilith were both created directly by God, but Lilith refused to submit to her husband during sex. She did not want to be on the bottom. She wanted to take the superior position. And this is, of course, metaphorical for wanting to exercise rulership over
power,
her husband.
Yeah,
to usurp his authority. And so she gets cursed and she becomes this night demon and spawns other monsters. And then God creates Eve out of Adam's rib. So there's this story that's quite old.
Where does that story originate?
Well, there is a term, the Lilitu demon, which is an ancient Near East. It's a non-Jewish term. You see this, I think it's Sumerian. But it does show up in the Bible, in just like a random place. It doesn't describe what it is, just throws that out there.
Just the term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so later Jewish folklore will
they built on that, maybe.
Will build on that. Yeah. There, much more recently, like in the Victorian period, you will see people talking about the serpent seed theory, which is that, that Eve actually mates with the serpent
and has
children that are literally children of the devil. And I think that's probably, if we had to trace where this modern serpent seed theory is, that's where that comes from.
Okay, so when people use this term, they're not talking about what I just said. They're talking about some extra stuff.
So this new thing that's happening is you've got God's – so God curses the ground. He curses the serpent, but he does not curse Adam and Eve in Genesis. He gives them consequences. He says that you'll increase your pain in childbirth. You will work the ground and it will not produce for you as it did before. But
hey, guys. Sarah Stone here. Sorry to interrupt what I'm sure is a riveting podcast episode, but Theology by the Pint needs your help to continue providing these podcasts, offering our in-person events, and growing so we can bring thoughtful conversation and the hope of the gospel to a world that's increasingly walking away from church and from faith. Now that we're a 501c3 nonprofit, all donations are tax deductible, so we've crunched the numbers, and if each listener of this episode gave just $1 for each episode you listen to, we'd put a huge dent in our annual budget. So consider giving today. Go to theologybythepint.org/give and click the link to donate. Thanks so much, and now back to our show.
To the serpent, he says, on your belly you shall go all the days of your life, dust you will eat. And then we've got what's called the proto-evangelium, the first giving of the gospel, where he promises to Eve that her seed will crush the head of the serpent, but the seed of the serpent will bruise his heel. That interpretation is ancient. Like, that goes back to the patristic tradition. That's nothing newfangled and YouTube-y. But they pair that with Genesis 6 and with this coming down of the sons of God to the daughters of men, and they see that they're beautiful and they take them for wives to themselves, and they beget children. And then it says, and the giants or the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. These were the mighty men of old, men of renown. And so the idea is these fallen angels come down, they mate with human women, they create this race of giants who are half demon and half human, and you've now got this evil hybrid race that is cohabitating with the pure human beings, the seed of the woman. And that's why, for instance, you've got to go in and conquer Canaan, because you're not just doing this generic warfare, you're literally cleansing these demonic half-breeds from the land. And this is the position that Michael Heiser takes, for instance.
And is that why the Israelites, except for Caleb and
Joshua
were afraid?
Because they said we're like grasshoppers to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll
get into that more for sure. But because you just said one of the theories, and we'll kind of spell out the others. But maybe just before we leave this whole seed war thing, is there also, there's something here about Cain? Right? Isn't there like a, I mean,
so Cain, you know, the story gets a curse, Cain and Abel. Cain gets a mark that's placed on him by God. And this is, Cain says, anybody who meets me is going to kill me. Well, who's going to meet Cain?
When he goes off to the cities.
Yeah. Well, what cities if there's only these?
We've talked about that on the show too.
Anyway, so Cain says, anybody that finds me is going to kill me. And so he gets a particular mark that shows who he is and what his penalty shall be. We see a curse of Cain. So Beowulf, for instance, Anglo-Saxon literature will mention that Grendel and his mother and these other monsters, elves and dwarves and ents and things, come from the spawn of Cain, the cursed of God. So in that sense, that's a fairly old tradition, but I don't know if we want to go around talking about elves.
Well, I don't think we want to today, but so – you would say then the people, the YouTube-y people, as you say, might put Cain in the same, in the sort of seed of Satan.
Yeah, it seems to me, I'm not an expert on this particular field, but it seems to me that they want to have some sort of idea of interbreeding. And so any sort of questionable progeny that they can find in scripture that has a supernatural element to it, they want to slap that label on there.
Yeah. So let's go there. I mean, so a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, or that we're going to be talking about, very little of it actually comes from the Bible, though some does. But a lot of it comes from the Book of Enoch, the Book of Jubilees, the Book of Giants, but mostly from the Book of Enoch, which I did not let myself read in preparation for this, because I don't trust that I wouldn't find it too fascinating, because I think this stuff is kind of fascinating, and I thought, oh, maybe I better not. But before we like say what is in it and talk about the Watchers and Edgar Gore and all that kind of stuff, what is the Book of Enoch, and why didn't it make it into what we call the canon?
So the Book of Enoch is It is a book which most people would say is a composite of several other books, and it's got a long reception history. It was written at some point during the intertestamental period, which is the period between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, some point after the Babylonian captivity in particular. And it has several different segments. The one that most people are going to talk about is the very first segment, which is called the Book of the Watchers. And this is Enoch, the seventh from Adam, who gets says, and he was not, for God took him. This is sort of the start of the Book of Enoch, that Enoch is in heaven and he's wandering around, and these watchers who have fallen, they've done the giant thing in Genesis 6. They appeal to Enoch actually to take their message to God and to the divine council, and to ask that they be let off the hook. And God tells Enoch to take the message back to the watchers and to execute judgment upon them and to declare his judgment, to say that they will not be declared innocent, that they will instead face his wrath. And there's description of the various names of these fallen mm-hmm. watchers and the various skills that they were said to have taught human beings in their interactions with them, skills like astronomy, metalworking,
apothecary,
the making of weapons. Yeah, so various pharmaceutical things, makeup and cosmetics is a forbidden knowledge in this book. But even in the Book of the Watchers, that it's a pretty small segment of that book, this discussion of who the Watchers are and what they do. Most of it has to do with Enoch's kind of tour of the afterlife. And he goes various places and sees these visions of how the universe is put together. This is Sheol, and this is where these souls will go, and this is heaven, and this is the judgment place for the fallen stars, all this sort of stuff. So the Book of Enoch very much postdates what we see in Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're a liberal Bible scholar, in which case...
You think everything was written in the exile.
Anything is free game. So...
We just alienated half our listeners. So, cool. But come to our events and argue your case.
Well, you know? I mean, if you're a liberal Bible scholar, you will probably describe yourself as a liberal Bible scholar. And I'm not saying anything that anybody would...
There was a tone,
would
Austin.
Well, I disagree tone. With you, but... it seems to me... let me back up. The intertestamental period is where we see this huge proliferation in Jewish fascination with angels and demons and Satan and Adam and all of this, and giants and all of this stuff. That's the time period. And so that's why most people want to date the Book of Daniel to that time.
Yep.
Post Alexander the Great, post the things that it's supposed
to. Well, yeah, because then it couldn't have prophesied.
Because then it couldn't have been a prophecy. Right. Yep. And so Daniel's kind of doing the Dante thing, and he's writing, setting it beforehand and saying it's a prophecy when really it's already happened. But it seems to me just as likely that if Daniel is one of the last books of the Old Testament to be written, and everybody knows that it's inspired and part of God's word, then Daniel is the one that talks the most about these sorts of things. And why wouldn't they take that as a jumping off point? And that would be the start of all of their interest.
So you're saying because of that, whoever made this decision didn't include the Book of Enoch because they thought it was a little like late to the party?
No. I'm just saying that this proliferation of discussion could just as much be caused by Daniel as Daniel could be caused by that.
Sure.
But why did Enoch not make it into the Bible? Well, first of all, it depends on which church you belong to, because their Ethiopian church has Enoch in their scriptures, for instance.
Really? Interesting.
The reason Enoch didn't make it is the same reason any of these other ancient texts didn't make it. It was not written in Hebrew, as far as we know. The Jews never considered it to be part of their canon. We have, in the first century, we've got Josephus already. It's either Josephus or Philo, I forget. There's already a sort of canonical list in the first century. These, what we would now call the apocryphal books or the pseudepigraphal books, those are two different categories, but they're related. Yeah. They don't make it onto there. This is not something that the Jews considered to be sacred prior to that time. Part of the way that you can diagnose which one is which is what original language was it written in? And First Enoch,
it's handy.
We don't have a Hebrew First Enoch. We have various different manuscript languages, including some fragments in Aramaic, but it does not seem to have been part of the cut at any time. So there's no conspiracy where people are sort of the priests in power are attempting to suppress this forbidden knowledge. Like, it's not. It's free online. You can go to Project Gutenberg and read it, you know. it was never considered to be canonical unless you're in a particular... Yeah.
This is a book, though, when people ask me about it, it's like they pull me aside and it's like, hey, you ever read the Book of Enoch?
Yeah.
You
know, they open a cloak and inside there's like copies of it.
Yeah. It's like an envelope with cash.
Yeah, I think Enoch gets treated as if it's like the Necronomicon of Christian or Jewish literature, and it's not. Like, it's really not anything that weird.
Yeah.
It's very much in line with a ton of other documents from that time period, and most of it has to do with God's judgment on the wicked and his deliverance of the good. And it is an apocalyptic genre. So it's very much in line with Daniel, with Revelation, with a lot of the Essene literature that you see coming out of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's not that weird, all told, if you're familiar with the literature of the time.
I mean, sure. Revelation is pretty weird. Yeah. Ezekiel is pretty weird.
Daniel.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's some pretty weird stuff.
So there, speaking of the Bible that we use and the weird stuff, a lot of people will say, oh, well, the Book of Enoch is quoted by the Bible. And when I was preparing for this podcast, it looks like there's maybe only one sort of direct reference, but there are other things that are like pretty close. But in Jude 1, it says, it was also about these that Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied, saying, behold, the Lord comes with 10,000 of his holy ones to execute judgment on all and to convict all the ungodly of their deeds of ungodliness that they have committed in such an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things that ungodly sinners have spoken against him. And per Google, that is a direct quote from the Book of Enoch.
Yes.
So if a canonical book that we consider sacred and inspired is quoting this other book, it does, I can see why people will be like, well, maybe that's an important book. It might not have made the cut, but it seems like it might be right about some stuff.
Yeah. Well, as Gandalf says, when in doubt, follow your nose.
Okay. And what does that mean for us?
Well, what that means is, do you see what I did there? I quoted a character of us know are fictional.
Yes.
And I'm using it to illustrate a point, which is true, but I'm not
so
making,
meta.
I'm not making any particular claim as to the historicity or the canonicity of Gandalf. And if anybody were going to do that, you know it would be me. I've never really seen the controversy. I think that Jude can just as well be drawing on a well-known literary document that he thinks makes a good – because Paul does this as well. Uh-huh. Paul quotes Epimenides. Paul quotes Aratus. Paul quotes these other pagan philosophers.
Interesting, right?
The quotes that Paul is laying out at the Mars Hill sermon, those poems are about Zeus.
Yeah.
And he's saying that he's using them to talk about Yahweh.
Yeah.
So I don't think Paul is claiming canonical status for those books. I don't see any reason
really
why we
point.
Would claim canonical status for Enoch. But you're right. It does mean that maybe it's important. What it does tell us is Jude knew Enoch.
Mm-hmm.
Jude saw some valid insights in Enoch.
Mm-hmm.
It also sort of undermines this idea that Enoch is this forbidden tome that none shall speak of. I mean, it's there. It's quoted in the New Testament.
You might get to this later, so cut me off. But I mean, as I'm listening, and I'm not very familiar with a lot of these ideas, and as Lutherans, we don't really talk, you know, Lutherans, I don't have a lot of people coming up to me like, hey, have you read this? You know,
which but is like, weird, because if anybody wanted to talk about fighting the devil, it was Martin Luther.
That's true. That's true. But like, I'm trying to kind of take a step back and be like, well, what is happening with these texts? Like, are there evangelical Christians out there who are doing this kind of deep dive, which is what is happening? Is it leading them away from faith in Christ? Is it taking them into occult directions?
That's the big question on the table.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Once we kind of unpack it all.
That's the big question. So I've already said his name once. Michael Heiser, who has now passed away, was the big name on the scene over the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me stop you related to that. I have a member who's come up to me and he said, hey, I'm reading this Michael Heiser guy and I'm reading about the, you said it on our last podcast, the hierarchy of gods or
Table
something.
Table of Nations or? No.
Yeah, that. And
Divine
anyway,
Council, all that.
The Divine
stuff.
Council.
Yeah.
And so should I be worried about him? Like, is he?
No,
is
Divine he starting? Council. No, Divine okay, Council okay. is right there on the pages okay. of Scripture. But the like Michael Heiser did a lot of good.
I didn't think so, friend.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Michael Heiser did a lot of good work. There are a lot of really significant hesitations I have about Heiser's methodology and some of the conclusions he came to. So like basic project, sure.
Yeah.
Details of the project, maybe not. And so one of the things that happens is I think Heiser gives way too much prominence to the Book of Enoch in his exegesis of like the whole narrative of Scripture. Oh, okay. And this is what often happens is we've got Enoch, which talks about Genesis 6, and therefore we put those two things together as if they're the same document.
That's the story we're working with.
And that's the story. But Enoch is written centuries after Genesis, like Genesis 6, 1 through 4. There's four verses. That's all we have to go with in the actual inspired canon of Scripture. What Enoch has to say is absolutely meaningless in interpreting Genesis 6.
So definitely, it, like 1,000 years later.
It only, yeah. I mean, I'm not gonna get into it, but yeah.
That's good. You're married. Okay, let me stop.
Enoch is only significant in interpreting Genesis 6 to the extent that Jews in many, many later centuries are reading this text in their interpretive community in that way. But what the original author had to say back in Genesis 6, what Moses had to say, they're not related.
So this, okay, so we're going to get into the whole Watchers and the Nephilim thing because you can understand why someone would do this. When they read Genesis 6, I'm going to read what we have. And then they hear, oh, there's this other book that was sort of esteemed mm-hmm. by some of our other biblical writers. And it gives more information about this weird, mysterious thing. You see why people would be like, well, I'm going to go read that and put these ideas together. But yeah, then it can get weird. So what we have from our Bible that we believe is inspired and, sacred and made into the canon, all that jazz, and written by Moses. Yes, this part. Genesis 6 says, and I'm reading from the ESV, says, when man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God, that's the weird, what are we going to do with that?
Elohim.
Saw that the daughters of man were attractive.
By the way, man here is Adam. Yeah.
Okay.
In Hebrew.
Man.
It's a generic word for man.
Yeah. So okay. Adam means man.
Okay, so just
when dudes. Well, could be dudes,
could be.
But
humanity.
I think the ambiguity between Adam as a person and Adam as humanity is intentional.
Okay, So the sons of God saw the daughters of men were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years." We're not going to get into the 120 years thing. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days. Just there it is. Just boom. Just. Where did they come from, mm-hmm. right? Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, talk about PG-13, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown, and then wickedness gets so bad, and then we get the Noah and the Ark story. But, so that's all we have to go mm-hmm. on. The book of Enoch fills in some of those gaps, maybe, and it talks about these sons of heaven as being the watchers, and you referred to the watchers earlier, they're also called the wakeful ones or the egregore. Maybe you can unpack that for us. So tell us a little bit about, you already mentioned the watchers are maybe these like fallen angels that have some kind of, they're mixing and mingling with earth, and they're also teaching these esoteric
So notice things. In Genesis, in the Bible, the word watcher is not used.
Except that they would say later in Daniel it is.
In Daniel, it is. We'll go there. Yes, it is mentioned once in Daniel.
Well, they'd say three times.
So the idea of the watchers existing in Genesis 6 is not in the text.
Right.
Okay, that is in Enoch. That is just as relevant as whatever John Milton has to say about Genesis, right?
Okay.
Like it's fan fiction.
That's your second Miltonian reference in this podcast.
You should read series. Milton. So the watcher nexus of mythology is something that is extra biblical. It is imposed upon the text from without. Mm-hmm. The interpretation of Genesis 6, 1 through 4 is its own thing. And if you'll notice, by the way, like even the etymology of the word Nephilim is contested.
Okay.
The most common etymology that you'll hear is it comes from the Hebrew nephal, meaning fallen ones, that they fall down. But that's not...
Because they're so big. Well, let me stop.
It's not necessarily sure. In the Genesis text, it doesn't even actually criticize what the Nephilim are doing.
Hmm.
It just says they're doing it. And then it says... I mean, it doesn't criticize what the sons of God are doing. Just says that they're doing it. And then it says, oh, and by the way, the Nephilim were around. It's by implication in the next chapter that we see maybe this was bad because wickedness begins to multiply mm-hmm. on the earth. That's how we see the Dead Sea Scroll community begin to take it. That's how we see intertestamental people begin to take it. But there's been studies done on that phrase that they were in the earth and this time and afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
That's some sort of translation would be before and afterwards. Like the Nephilim were around before this and also after that. So
after the writing of that. After that part in the history.
Yeah, so you've got some scholars that want to argue the Nephilim is, this is actually not related to what the sons of God are doing at all. These are two different statements, but they are chronologically juxtaposed.
Okay,
like
okay.
At the same time that the sons of God are doing this,
there were some Nephilim.
The Nephilim had also been around before that and after that. So you've got these Apkallu or these sage figure, these pre-flood sages in other ancient Near Eastern mythologies, which have a lot of relevance intertextually for what's going on in these documents. And that seems to be maybe what Moses is going at here, is the legends of these sages from ancient times. This is where they were. And they're not these divine figures necessarily. They're just these heroes, human heroes.
And just to take you way back, I mean, years ago, we did an episode. Actually, my dad was our guest, and we talked about the Nephilim, and we talked about that's one of the sort of theories about – well, and I want to make a distinction. There's two sort of character archetypes or something in the text, regardless of Book of Enoch. There's the sons – let me go back to it. There's the sons of God. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that sounds like either possess men or actually themselves have sex with women, and that's not great. But then there's also the Nephilim. And so those are two separate things, but some people think the Nephilim are the like result of.
Yes. So the other standard reading that is more common, especially in the – well – in the YouTube community and elsewhere, the standard reading is the Nephilim are the offspring of the mating of these angels with these human women.
And by the way, that's not just YouTube. I mean, that's like prominent scholars and very conservative Christians.
That is a very well-established position. In the Septuagint and in other places, that word Nephilim is translated into Greek as gigantes, which is where we get our word giant from.
Yeah.
So again, what did Moses mean by that when he's writing that in the Bronze Age? Maybe not. Like, the Septuagint is just a translation.
Yeah.
And it takes place many centuries afterwards.
Yeah.
But at least at the time of the Septuagint, which was the Bible that was the Bible in the New Testament, that's translated as gigantes or earthborn or however you want to say that.
What were you going to say, Evan? I saw you getting...
Well, I thought that angels were immaterial beings.
Yeah,
so this is why the possession thing is where I land.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, by the way, all of the people that are into the Book of Enoch.
I don't understand what you're saying. Like, my question was, if they're immaterial, then
how can they have sex?
Yes. So you're saying they're not doing that. That's not what this text is saying. You're saying it's more about possession.
In my mind, there's a couple, and not my, in my studies, there's a couple camps. There's people that actually think that the watchers could copulate. Like, they had the necessary parts. And that's a whole stream of thinking that I'm not that's not where I find myself.
Okay.
And then I think, like when I was saying, there are plenty of like conservative scholars. I think there are plenty of people that think that they possessed men, earthly men.
Okay.
And did their evil deeds.
I see. So they used a man to do what they wanted to do.
Okay. As their puppet.
The other theory, for the completely demythologized theory, is that sons of God either means human kings, or it means people in the line of Seth, this righteous line, that are then basically taking pagan wives, the daughters of men, the non-believers. That's another position that is often...
That was the position my dad took when he was on here, the heroes of old kind of
thing. But I think the scholarly consensus has kind of swept around that. Yeah, that probably is some sort of supernatural beings.
Mm-hmm.
Show me a verse in the Bible that says angels are immaterial spirits.
I don't know.
There really isn't one. I mean, angels are certainly described as spirits, but so are humans.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, and technically they're messengers. That's the Greek version.
Angel is a job title, not a species.
And they do speak to...
Well, Mary saw one, and Zechariah saw one, and Daniel saw one.
I guess, though, if I think about demonic possession, though, I mean, it's like, how do you have two material things? So it's, I guess I assume spiritual nature.
So the idea, the idea of angels as lacking in bodies really only becomes dominant after Thomas Aquinas. And it's because...
Because they wanted to know how many could dance on the head of a pin.
Well, because Thomas is borrowing Aristotelian metaphysics and Aristotle, because of Aristotle's – well, I won't get into that.
Okay.
But,
okay.
Yeah.
So back to the – so the narrative, as far as we know, we have this Nephilim situation that we've just kind of unpacked the major theories about that. You said the Septuagint is where we get the word that we think of as giants. Mm-hmm. So let's just talk about giants for a second. We can come back to Mount Hermon and all that stuff. But I learned at some point, and I don't know where I learned this, that the Nephilim were the offspring and that they were giants. And that's where we get, like you were referring to, the conquest narratives talking about giants in the land, which we do see. And then you also get terms like the Rephaim. Mm-hmm. And you even hear, like, after the flood, which of course the conquest was, but you hear things like, oh, Goliath was one of the last of those that were still around. Rephaim, yeah. Or Og, who we hear the dimensions of his bed, which, by the way, the people in this world that we're talking about, the YouTubers and the podcast people that are into all this stuff, will say that the Og reference is interesting because the dimensions of his bed that are given actually mirror some kind of weird, like, this is a very PG-13. Yes. We're going to have to put an explicit rating on this, but they mirror some of the, like,
the sacred marriage bed in the temple of Etemenaki in Babylon. Yes.
Okay. I thought it was like Marduk or something. But
Marduk is the god that uses the bed.
Oh, okay. But some weird temple sex stuff.
Mm-hmm. Ritual marriage.
Yeah, I was on Wayfair the other day. I was like, king, queen.
Oh my God.
Amenaki.
Wayfair.
So that is a claim that gets put out. But actually, if you go back to the sources, there are two different dimensions for that bed given.
Okay.
The temple of Etemenaki, Marduk's bed. And the earlier one is smaller. And that one gets destroyed or stolen. I forget which one. And then a new one gets constructed, and that one is bigger, and that's the dimensions that match the bed of Og. Mm. So this is the issue with talking about Watchers and Babylonian and all that stuff and trying to read that back into Genesis 6 is that it implies that Genesis 6 is much later in date than most evangelicals will want to put it.
Yeah. Okay, but just to this idea, forget Og's bed, but just this idea that there are possibly giants roaming around. Well, I guess there are a couple questions. One, why were they not all wiped out in the flood? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously they were wiped out, but then I guess the problem continues.
Restarts maybe, who knows?
Yeah. And then how did we get rid of them? Or did we? Because there is a whole bunch of people that think that, like, Bigfoot and various other sightings are, like, left over.
Yeah, I've never heard that one until you mentioned it. But this is one of the
Stump the Professor.
Yeah, this is one of the hermeneutical problems. Is in Joshua, when the spies go into to scout out the land, they say, "We saw the sons of Anak. They are of the Nephilim, and we were like grasshoppers to them, and so we seemed to them." So, okay, well, if the flood is global and if the purpose of the flood was to wipe out and cleanse this demonic interbreeding, how then do we still have Nephilim after the flood? And some people want to say, well, it's because they are disembodied spirits and they just detached and came back in. This is like Scientology now.
Oh, my gosh.
Or they repossessed, the problem recrops up. Some people will say, well, this is proof that the flood wasn't global. The flood was just in the inhabited world there, and there are people that survived. There's my instinct is this is a hyperbolic statement that the spies have already proven themselves untrustworthy because they're disobedient to God. They're not trusting God. And they're like, oh my gosh, these people are like giants.
Right.
They're
they used huge, a lot of hyperbole in the rest of those conquests.
So the sons of Anak are definitely around. Or we hear a lot of people referred to as the Anakim. But again, is this a literal ascription to say the same entities that existed prior to the flood are now also here? Or is this a literary mode of expression to describe the fact that these people are big and tough? I don't know. I don't know which one it is. But you've got a lot of these terms in this nexus here. The Anakim, the Nephilim, the Rephaim, the Zamzumim, the Imim, all of these Eems, which, by the way, is Hebrew plural. Rephaim gets mentioned a lot. Og is said to be one of the Rephaim. There is not a single definition for what Rephaim means. In some places, it seems to mean giant. In some places, it seems to just be the tribe of Rephah. In some places, it seems to be a geographical designator. There's a valley called the Valley of the Rephaim.
I was just about to ask you about the Gilgal Rephaim, the ring, or the Circle of Giants.
Yeah, that's a modern name. That was not a name that was given
Back.
That's a tourist name.
Do you guys ever listen to Art Bell?
No.
Coast Rob? To Coast AM?
No.
Space I was going to say Rob. Yeah.
No, Rob Bell. No, what, Art Bell. no, I mean, Art Bell's a radio genius, and he had a TV, you know, AM late night radio show where he talked about all this sort of things. Mm-hmm. And every now and then I'd listen. And he's, again, you should listen to some old Art Bell stuff because he's a radio genius. But he would talk about Bigfoot and UFOs and government conspiracies and mm-hmm. everything you can imagine. And
cryptics, so, as they say.
And he had one guy on one night talking about giants. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a whole book. And, you know, he claims that people have found, like, you know, 5-foot femurs.
Uh-huh. Right?
So, yeah. They're in a lot of museums. It's called dinosaur bones.
Well, he said that
you believe in dinosaurs?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I'm joking.
Anyway, so there is a whole school of thought, and I would assume that at some point it kind of links to, you know, the guy that's popular on Netflix right now that's going around talking about, like, how you have, like, pyramids in this part of the world and that part of the mm-hmm. world. What's his name?
I don't know.
Anyway. So there's that whole kind of movement too of like people looking at, hey, look at these ancient civilizations. They're all building the same pyramid with the same architectural styles. And, you know, how do they do it? And there's some like pyramid supposedly like the South Pole, you know, where.
Well, that actually gets me to the last thing I was going to talk about before we wrap this up and say, hey, should we stay away from this?
Is it H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness?
So you took the words right out of my mouth.
Sorry.
No, ley lines. Okay, cool. But. Part of the Book of Enoch talks about this whole thing that happened at Mount Hermon, which mm-hmm. is a real place. And
it's a ski resort.
Okay.
It's the highest mountain in Israel.
Okay. And I guess in the Book of Enoch, this is also where like the Watchers came down, yes. But it's where also where
they make their pact to all rebel and deceive humanity.
Okay. But it's also where many people believe that like some of the Nephilim or these weird hybrid whatevers are like buried beneath the earth, but they're still alive, like in a hellish sort of Sheol-y kind of
Tartarus.
Maybe I don't know.
So there is a verse that says that the angels are bound in chains in Tartarus until the day of judgment. In Revelation, there's the verse that says that heaven says, "Release the four angels that are bound mm-hmm. at the River Euphrates." River Euphrates is not near Mount Hermon, so. I don't know.
No, you have to take a ley line to get there.
Yeah. So ley lines, by the way.
Say what that is.
Ley lines are these alleged lines of energy or, you know.
Connection.
Yeah, connection points. And the idea was that the ancient pagans would travel these rituals from place to place along these lines of energy. This is all made up.
It's actually very recent.
Yes. Like, it's hilariously recent. Like, all of
the. Like, 1900s maybe even.
So the. Modern Wicca, all of the major ideas of modern Wicca come from like 1950.
Yeah, I think the ley lines started in like the 20s.
Ley lines is a little earlier.
Why Stonehenge is where it is?
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff is all connected.
Glastonbury and all these things.
And you mentioned the pyramids, which is, I'm sure, connected. Yeah,
the cool thing about geometry is that you can draw a line between any two points on Earth.
Yeah, we're recording this before the eclipse that's happening, and people are losing their minds about the lines you can draw from cities that have biblical names.
Seven that have the name Nineveh. Yeah.
Oh!
So ley lines are a modern invention. They have no evidence behind them whatsoever. There's no connection to the ancient world at all. Period.
Love it. Okay. So all of this stuff that we're talking about, while interesting, and myth is so fun. I mean, whether it's myth that is pointing to something true myth, or if it's just a story that's a fun story to think about, I guess... The bigger question is, because the people that I'm listening to are really into this, and it's not just a fun story for them. Mm-hmm. Like, Aura could have been, huh? We'll never know until one day we can ask God about it. It is like a mission to find these things, to bind them. We have power over them. The way we talk and the music we listen to can like pull them in or out mm-hmm. of. Maybe just say a few words about, do we need to be careful about how we think about this kind of thing? What are... You know, some words of encouragement or hope around.
Well, the most pernicious thing I would say is if you follow this seed war hypothesis, this idea that there can be such things as interbreedings and there can be pure bloodlines that have kept themselves free and then bloodlines which have been corrupted and have in somewhere in their ancestry, they have demonic hybrids.
Oh, yeah, we didn't even talk about the curse of
Ham. I think we can see how that would be dangerous, right?
Yes.
I think we can see that could end really, really terribly.
Ethically.
Yeah.
Especially. Yeah.
So let's not do that.
okay.
Especially on such slim biblical evidence.
Yeah.
To say that that's what was happening. Absolutely, we should not be looking for which races or cultures are more or less influenced by the serpent seed. Unless insofar as any and all cultures are influenced by the fall and by Satan and the devil, which is to say, they are.
Everybody.
Well, the Nation of Islam, when it uses the word white devil, it literally means white people are have been bred by a weird mad scientist. Their origin story is unusual. Malcolm X writes about it in his autobiography after he
released sort of fascinating new religious movement. Mm-hmm. So that's, and it's the same impulse behind this other historical revisionism, like the mud flood, all this weird stuff that history has been reconstructed. History has been falsified to cover up these things. Post-truth. But the good news is Jesus Christ has victory over sin and death and the devil.
Let's go.
And it doesn't matter if the devil is inhabiting a human being or if the devil has created a race of giants or any of this other stuff. Like, the end is the same. God is always in control. Yes, there is a divine counsel. Yes, there are demonic foes that are active and in this world right now. But Jesus Christ is the king of all creation. And Jesus Christ by himself can defeat and destroy all of these things. He doesn't need us. And he has promised us that he will defeat and destroy them. And here's the privilege, is that he allows us to participate in that activity. So he commissions us with his power and with his authority to be able to go out and to express the authority over other over forces of evil.
Yeah, I love that.
But here's the thing. He also commissions us to have a day job.
Yep.
Right? So yes, on one hand, I want to affirm that spiritual warfare is real and it's important, and Christians need to wake up to its presence in our culture. On the other hand, going back to Martin Luther, you know the anecdote where they asked Martin Luther, what would you do if you knew Jesus was coming back?
Plant a tree.
Yeah. I thought he said I would finish planting this row of cabbages or something.
Oh, okay.
There's planting, either way.
But I think it's a legend either way. But yeah, hey, I have planted three trees recently, so I just want to say that.
The idea is sometimes Jesus tells them, leave your nets and follow me. Sometimes he tells the leper, stay in or the person that he's healed, stay in your village, right? Don't come with me. Mm-hmm. Different people have different callings. All of us are called to be faithful where we are. And so we don't need to go and build bunkers or go off the deep end trying to create a conspiracy. Let's focus instead on the divine conspiracy, as Dallas Willard would put it. Let's focus on how we can be faithful where we are stationed here.
Yes.
And not forsake the means of ordinary grace and ordinary being together, ordinary discipline and spiritual formation to go off after the glitzy, glamoury stuff.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I love that.
We go where we are called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you tell people about the winning team, right? Yeah, you tell people and you implore them to surrender themselves to Christ.
Yeah. It seems like there's someone said once the part of your brain that's activated by conspiracy theories is the same that is excited by like shoplifting. Hmm. You know, it's the thrill of secret knowledge or something, getting away with something. And so I wonder if this people going down all these rabbit holes is like more knowledge.
This is why I did not read the Book of Enoch, because I could feel that the impending thrill of that.
It's not what you think it is.
Okay, well.
But so
Sounds like a letdown.
It's useful. It's edifying, I guess. It's edifying in a lot of ways. But the whole conspiracy theory thing that's proliferating now, part of it is that we live in an age where anything can be falsified and we now can't verify our information. Part of it is we're now swinging back into this mythologization.
Mm-hmm.
We're re-paganizing. I've said that before. So people can't live in a disenchanted world, and now they're looking for avenues in which they can re-enchant it, and conspiracy theories are a way of doing that.
Absolutely.
That's why even if you don't like Bigfoot, you will watch a Bigfoot documentary on the History Channel because you wish that you lived in a world where Bigfoot existed.
Interesting.
And so if you can convince yourself via a conspiracy theory or a network of plausibility that such a thing does exist, then it's very compelling because this is how human beings are made.
Yeah. But you should write a book about that.
The danger with conspiracy theories is not it's not that you can just falsify them so easily. You can't, actually. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to falsify a conspiracy theory. That's the danger. That all you have to do is say, well, that person's in on it, right?
Yes.
They're hiding it. This document got changed. That got removed.
Yep.
Right? You can counter any evidence with that same move. But what happens is when you're standing at the end of this long process, you have now, in order to make this thing plausible, you have now made the whole rest of your world implausible rather than the other way around.
Yeah, you look at like the boat in Baltimore that hit the bridge, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like immediately there are people who are saying, oh, and I'm not saying one way or another. I don't know. But
I we can talk about this on White Pill Radio, I guess. But that's the impulse. The conspiracy theory impulse is the mythic impulse. It's the enchanted impulse.
Man, that's fascinating. Golly. Okay, well, once again, so good to have you on the show. Thank you for coming and talking about this kind of stuff. Absolutely. And if you have questions about this kind of stuff, I mean, contact us. We love talking about all of these things. Come to our events if you live in Houston, and you can come here and see Austin live and in person in May. But until we see you again or talk about weird woo-woo things again, we encourage you, as always, to question freely, think deeply, and disagree as needed.